to see everybody tonight on this Lord's Day. It's been a pleasant day, a good day. And I trust it's been the same for you as well. Well, if you're coming tonight and you weren't here this morning, you're kind of coming in the middle of a study, but I guess that's true if you come into any part of David and you hadn't been through the whole part. But we had started this morning the study of Absalom and the battle that takes place there in the woods of Ephraim against David. And if you missed out, I would highly suggest to go to the website and try and pick it up. I enjoyed studying that lesson this morning, and I pray you would profit from that study as well. In fact, any of them, I've really enjoyed this series a whole lot. As you know, I like preaching on narratives and to get into the very storyline itself. And I've poured many hours of reading, reflection, and study so that whatever text it is in the life of David, I try to do the best I can. So tonight's lesson I've titled, "O Absalom, My Son, My Son." There comes a time in life when it will have run its course. The last word is said, the last action is done. But it is always tragic when based upon foolish decisions that it happens to the young. In my short life, I've seen it a number of times. I'm sure and some of those of you that live longer have seen it many times. And many other generations before us had also seen it the same as well. David had hoped by reminding his soldiers that Absalom was a young man, that it might bring him mercy. But David's desire would be far from David's reality. And David's brilliant battle strategy will lead to David's intense agony in the end. Now let's turn back there to 2 Samuel 18. Remember where we left Absalom? There he is hanging from the tree, twisting and turning, just trying to break free, to break loose. You know, I'll mention this in passing. You know, there's certain lessons that the kids will pay attention a little more and share with me their drawings. And this one's had its share of drawings, you know, with Absalom hanging from the tree by his hair. I'm glad to know that they're listening. Well, there in 2 Samuel 18, verse 10, as he's hanging there, it says, "Now a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, 'I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree.' So Joab said to the man who told him, 'You just saw him? And why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt.'" He says, "What? You saw him and you didn't kill him? I would have greatly rewarded you if you would have done that." Now, Joab clearly wants Absalom dead. But remember the commandment of David as the army was leaving out to deal gently with the young man Absalom. And the soldier certainly did remember that. So why would Joab want him dead so badly? Well, remember in our narrative, it was Joab who arranged for Absalom to return back home originally. And it was also Joab that obtained Absalom a political pardon from his crime of murdering his brother Amnon. And all of this only to undertake a coup d'etat and try to take the government away from David? Joab indeed feels responsible, and in some way he is. And this has gone on long enough. And Joab knows this is a shortcut to spare a nation a long, bloody civil war. Absalom must die, regardless of what David says about it. But that's easy to say if you're a commander. As the soldier says, notice verse 12, "But the man said to Joab, 'Though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Beware, lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life. For there's nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself You yourself would have set yourself against me. I know what would have happened in the end. You'd have just left me hanging. This man is indeed principled. And we might also say brave to stand up to Joab. Not many people did that and lived. He says, you wouldn't have protected me. And you know, Joab doesn't reply because he knows it's probably true. So there in verse 14, Joab says, I can't linger with you. I don't have time for this, in essence. Doesn't answer his argument. Just show me where he is. He knew what needed to be done. And he knew what David would never bring himself to do. And Joab, well, he's never been squeamish about killing, even against those whom David wishes would live. You remember the story of Abner? Way back when, some probably almost near 30 years before this, when David was in his 30s, which is now is probably in his early 60s. And there they're trying to position David to be the next king. And some side deals are worked with Abner behind the scenes. Abner leaves. Joab comes back home. And he finds out, what? Abner's been here? And so he sends a secret message. David wants you to come back. So Abner travels back. And the Bible says that Joab met Abner at the gate. And he took him aside privately, as if to speak to him quietly, and then jabbed a knife right into his stomach, and he died. And this indeed devastated David, for he knew that Abner was a great general, commander, and even war hero. Well, Joab is shown the location of Absalom. And this is one of those scenes where I wish I had a video of. Could you imagine the first thoughts that Absalom has when he sees Joab there? Oh no. Oh no. And surely there had to be some exchange of words, and I would love to know what those words were. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Right. No, I don't think he said those words. That was for those that weren't here this morning, that was the title of the morning lesson. Verse 14 tells us that he took three spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. Did you notice that said thrust, not throw? I don't know for how long in my mind I've always envisioned him throwing the javelins. That's a different word. It says that he thrusts them. This was personal. And it wasn't just one, which Joab being an expert killer, all he would need was one. This was absolutely personal. This was torture in some ways. To take three, as if those three had some kind of meaning to him. We don't know. But I imagine him grabbing the back of Absalom's head, or depending on how high he is, maybe his waist, and thrusting the first javelin through. The second one. And then the third one. Again, there being three, it's personal. There's some meaning behind it. Maybe this one's for Amnon, this one's for David, and this one's for my barley field. Remember he burned it? I don't know. No one will ever know. But the Bible paints the picture. A very brutal and bloody scene. Then as blood flowed from the chest cavity, in poetic justice, Absalom gets a glimpse of what Amnon must have felt the moment that he died. Remember that? When Absalom told his servants, when I give the signal, you rise up and strike Amnon down. So Amnon had a bunch of men surround him and snuff his life out. And now he sees what Amnon saw, and it'll be the last thing that he sees in his life too. Notice there in verse 15, "And 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him." It was a bloody death. And with that, the rebellion is over. Verse 16, "So Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people." The war is over. The trumpet is blown. It did not need to continue anymore. The head of the snake had been cut off. And then verse 17 says, "They took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Absalom's corpse is flung into a hole in the forest and is covered in a pile of nameless stones." He wanted so badly to make a name for himself. But now he is left in a forest with no official burial marker. And the narrator next takes a little pause in verse 18 to show that this is very contrary to his wishes, his very prideful wishes about himself. Verse 18, it says, "Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the King's Valley. For he said, 'I have no son to keep my name in remembrance.' He called the pillar after his own name, Absalom, Pillar of Absalom," right? And to this day, it is called Absalom's Monument. Ironically, Saul is the only other king to have made a monument after himself. So in a lot of ways, like we said in earlier lessons, this is Saul the second and Absalom. When you think of Absalom dying this way, you can't help but think of the words of Moses when he said, "Cursed is everyone who hangs upon a tree." And this rushed burial implies that indeed he was cursed. Cut him down, get him down, throw him in a pit, and bury him with stones. It's ironic. It's very ironic because had he listened to Ahithophel, he would not have been there that day. Remember that? The advice of Ahithophel, you stay behind. But Hushai painted a glorious picture that Absalom could not refuse, and pride always goes before a fall. As we emphasized in our study this morning. And now Absalom is no more. At least not in this life. For we know that his soul is ushered to eternity. And dying in such a state of rebellion, and dying in such pride and such arrogance, we have very little hope for where he spends eternity. So sad. A life so young, snuffed out by his foolishness and his pride and his arrogance, to only begin a new life, one that never ends and is still going on to this very day. Makes it really sink home, doesn't it? Makes us really think very long and hard about the choices that we make in life as well. Well, now to break the news to David. How does this happen? Well, next comes the story of the runners. There in verse 19, "Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, 'Let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him on his enemies.' And Joab said to him, 'You shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead.'" It's almost as if Joab knows. He's been around David for so long. He knows how David interprets certain people, certain messengers, or certain people that he's familiar with in his life. And he knows that David would interpret Ahimaaz as a messenger of good news. We can't do that because the king's son is dead. So verse 21, Joab said to the Cushite, just a nameless individual, just tells us where he comes from, "Go and tell the king what you have seen." So the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and he ran. Joab chooses a random runner where there'd be no emotional connection. Just deliverance of the facts of war. But Ahimaaz doesn't give up that easily. Verse 22, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, "But whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite." So Joab said, "Why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready?" Verse 23, "But whatever happens," he said, "let me run." So he said to him, "Run." And Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain, and he outran the Cushite. Now David was between the two gates. And the watchman went up to the roof over the gate, to the wall, lifted his eyes and looked, and there was a man running alone. And the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, "If he's alone, there is news in his mouth." And he came rapidly and drew near. Right? It wasn't a whole bunch of men as if they were running in retreat. Right? There was just one man. There's news. He's a messenger. Verse 26, then the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called the gatekeeper and said, "There's another man running, and he's running alone." And the king said, "He also brings news." So the watchman said, "I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, notice how he responds, "Oh, he's a good man. And he comes with good news." There was something in his running style that identified Ahimaaz. You know, that's not far-fetched. I love to watch my kids run, and they all run differently. You know, sometimes I'm in here, you know, stuck talking with the brethren when it'd be nice to be outside and watch them playing tag, because it's funny to see them run. I enjoy it. And they all have their own style. And Ahimaaz had his particular gait, his particular run, and they were able to spot him. That's him, and he's a good man, and he'll bring some good news. Won't he? See, Joab knew David. He knew how he would interpret Ahimaaz coming. Notice David said he's a good man, as if that matters at all in regards to the news of war. I mean, it doesn't. David's grasping for straws. He's hoping the best news is about to come. He's in essence anxious and reassuring himself. Surely he'll bring good news. Won't he? He's like any parent who would be worried sick about their child if something traumatic had maybe happened. I remember the time when Penny got in a bike accident, and I knew I had to call Julie. I had to call her, and I was dreading that call. I knew most likely she was going to be okay, but I'm not a doctor, so I don't really know for sure. But hey, it's all right. Don't worry about it. I'm going to tell you something. Don't worry about anything. You know, it's okay. Oh, she just, you know, it was very traumatic for her. Oh, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. Well, how would I know that? I'm not a doctor, like I said. Well, I knew we had to take her to the emergency room, get the scan done, make sure there was no damage done. He's going to be all right, isn't he? Surely he'll be all right. Truly, it's a sad scene. Well, verse 28, Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, "All is well." And then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king." Notice the very first words of David. Verse 29. Is the young man Absalom safe? See, that message was no relief to David. It was as if Ahimaaz said nothing at all. There's just one question and one question alone that's on David's mind. How's my son, Absalom? Well, Ahimaaz gets cold feet and he rambles and pretends not to know. And he goes on to say there in verse 29, he answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I don't know what it was about. Well, about that time, the other runner arrives. So the king said, "Turn aside and stand here." So Ahimaaz turned aside and stood still. Just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, "There is good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you." Verse 32, the king said to the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" So the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man." So David, we see here, has no commendation for the soldiers that risked their lives for him. But he, like so many parents, had tunnel vision when it came to his child. Just wanted to know, is my child safe? In a very open yet tactful manner, the Cushite answers, doesn't he? "May all your enemies..." And notice he didn't say the word dead, did he? Didn't even mention Absalom by name. That's how tactful he is. "But may all the enemies of my Lord and those that seek to do harm be like that young man." And with that, David knew. And each word struck David with terrible impact. It was as if Joab's javelins had plunged into David's heart. So verse 33, the Bible says the king was deeply moved. And in the Hebrew, that literally means to shake. He began to tremble. See, for the moment, his personal feelings got in the way with his leadership duties for the kingdom. It was as if everything but David and his grief just ceased to exist. Everything stopped. The world stood still. And he could think of nothing else. And so in verse 33, he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, notice as he's walking, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son." 5 times he says, "Oh, my son." David was deeply hurt. But David was 1 degree removed from reality if he imagined that he could save both the throne and his son. So why is David so overtaken? Well, surely David thought of the great potential that his son had and all that was lost. The many talents that this young man had ultimately squandered and wasted. Surely he thought about his history and his past as a young lad, maybe on his knees. And all the family history of when Absalom was more of an innocent. But I have to wonder if there was another consideration in his mind as well. And that of his own contribution to all of this. See, he had never taken steps to correct his spoiled son. And as the proverb writer makes very, very clear, such a son brings grief to a father when they're left to their own. But also, David knows he is not without guilt himself through his adultery and his murder with Bathsheba and that of Uriah. And Nathan had said, "The sword shall never depart from your house, David. It will never depart. Your life will never be the same." Remember, that lesson was titled, "The Day Life Changed Forever." It would never be the same. And the thought of this fact would have added to his torment. Let us all listen carefully, well, to the lessons from God's Word. Children can be the greatest cause of joy, but they can also be the greatest cause of grief. And it often depends on how we, as parents, live our lives in the home. And as we, as parents, disciplined our children, or didn't. It's powerful. The Bible is replete of these lessons, and this is one of those, to warn us of that, to caution us against any errors we might be making, changes that might need to be taking place in the home, saying, while you can still yet listen to these words, there's still time. Change before it is too late. For Absalom, it was too late. And in the grief, we see that David forgot everything else. But think about this. Think of the hurt that was caused on others because of Absalom, David's son. See, in his sorrow, David is oblivious to the sorrow of others. And at least 20,000 other families lost a son in this war, or a father, or a brother, because of Absalom. My son, my son. And that would be a burden to bear in the days to come as well. All he could see, David, in this moment, though, was his loss. Yet, if we look at it from a higher standpoint, we see that a whole nation was spared in its darkest hour. Later on, there'd be a divided kingdom. But that could have happened much earlier if God providentially didn't help David out of this mess. It would cost a son, though. It would cost a son. We have to learn these lessons lest they come in our lives as well. I came upon this poem written by Longfellow. And Longfellow poetically wrote, "Somewhere at every hour, the watchman on the tower looks forth and sees the fleet approach of hurrying feet, of messengers that bear tidings of despair. O Absalom, my son, that 'tis a common grief bringeth slight relief. Ours is the bitter loss, ours is the heaviest cross. And forever the cry will be, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son." Poignant words, powerful words, and very true words. That feeling of remorse and regret, through all of that, David warns us all. Be careful of the choices that we make in life, and especially in family life. For as a man sows, that he also reaps. David says there in verse 33, if only I had died in your place. And as I pivot now towards the end of this lesson, I have to think about Jesus. For you know what David was unable to do, the Son of David did. Didn't he? Jesus died so that we need not die. He literally gave his life for mine and for yours. He is therefore the greater David. Isaiah 53 says, he came to bear our griefs and carry our sorrows, and the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. And by his stripes, we are healed. He said, I will die, and I will die in your place. See, the whole Bible, it's amazing. It's an amazing book. It's a book about Jesus, ultimately. That he does what nobody else does. So that we don't have to cry in regret. For he will carry our sorrows all away. Why would you not come to a king like that today? One that did the difficult. Nay, one who did the impossible. Lived a perfect life. And then gave it up for you and for me. On the cross of Calvary. And I love how the story of David always constantly keeps pointing to us to that greater David. To look in faith to him and trust in him. And that we're able to come before him with all of our faults and failings and shortcomings and sins. And when we repent and are baptized, they're all washed away. And to him, it's as if we never committed them at all. And that takes the sting away. Doesn't mean there's not any consequences. As we see in David's life, there were. But in Jesus, we can find forgiveness and healing. And if you're God's child and you've forsaken the Lord, why not come back to such a gracious King like that again? With a penitent heart and a willingness to make your life right. And if you need prayers from the congregation to confess a sin of public nature, we also stand ready and willing to help you along that line. But Jesus is there, willing and wanting to make you cleansed and whole once again, to carry all your sorrows away. Oh, Absalom, my son, may we learn these lessons. And may God help us to apply them in our lives. Won't you come while we stand and sing? Tis persuaded now to believe, almost persuaded Christ to receive. Seems not some soul to say, go, Spirit, go thy way. Some more convenient day on thee I'll